Today, we have a story for you about squirrels. It begins with the test of one man's patience.
There's been many days where I go to load up even just Khan Academy, which is a very simple site, and it just won't load the site. It just won't do it.
That's Matt Hall. He's talking about his internet. He lives in Hillsboro, Georgia, population about 700. He gets his internet through a DSL line. And hey, On Point listeners, before you laugh, just know that I, your supposedly highfalutin On Point host, I use DSL internet at my home in the middle of an urban area for more than 10 years. Until the copper line broke and the phone company just flat out refused to fix it. So I really feel Matt's pain. But I digress. Let's get back to Matt. Now, his DSL node also happens to serve 14 other households.
If more than one other person on the network in this community is using their internet for anything at all, then everyone else's becomes, you know, basically unusable. I have a weird sleep schedule to offset, so I stay up late at night to where less people are on, where I can get a little bit more done.
Matt used to be an EMT. He has a disability now and can't often leave the house. So to stay connected with other people and with friends, he plays a lot of Rocket League, a fast-paced video game of arcade-style soccer and vehicular mayhem. But you know, when your opponents are blasting through a game on fiber and you're plodding along on DSL, it isn't really a fair fight.
A lot of losses, unfortunately. We still try and grind it out just because it's the game that we've loved ever since it first came out.
Well, not only is the internet slow, it has some other problems. Enter the squirrels.
Squirrels keep chewing through this plastic box that the line runs through and chewing through the copper. And that drops all of our speeds down to usually like 0.1 to 0.3 megabits per second down.
You heard it. Squirrels are eating Matt's internet.
2021, and I have internet from, for some people, the late 90s and early 2000s.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point, and that is just the beginning of Matt's story. He's got a whole saga about how many hundreds of hours he's had to spend on the phone with the DSL company every time the squirrels strike. And his is just one example, just one of the tens of millions of Americans, especially in the rural United States, who struggle with unreliable or no access to high-speed internet at all. And let's admit it, like Matt said, it's 2021, and that is a national embarrassment. While getting the last mile wired up in rural America has been an issue that's enjoyed bipartisan political support for some time, but the support doesn't mean solutions. The latest shot at fixing the problem comes from the Biden administration and the American Jobs Act.
It creates jobs connecting every American with high-speed internet, including 35% of the rural America that still doesn't have it. This is going to help our kids and our businesses succeed in the 21st century economy.
Well, what specifically is in the Biden administration's proposal? Will it work? What does it not do? What solutions are out there that are already working for some local communities? That is what we are going to talk about today. And we'll start with Kathy Trimble, principal of the Francis Marion School in Marion, Alabama. Her school serves more than 600 students in grades 6 through 12. Ms. Trimble, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. How are you?
I'm well.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Describe to me what internet access is like for the kids at the Francis Marion School.
Internet access at Francis Marion School has been very interesting, to say the least. We, as many others, were crippled when the pandemic occurred last year in March. And so we were out of pocket, and our students were sent home. Now, for many in urban areas, they may have been sent home with the idea or with internet access, but when you're in a rural community, that is not the case. So they were sent home. We were fortunate, I should add, Meghna, that our school received the ConnectEd grant in 2015. So we were fortunate that all of our students had devices. We're a one-to-one initiative school. So all of them had devices. Now, a lot of people would think, hey, that's a plus. It is a plus if you have internet access.
Right.
Our broadband connectivity in the rural area is little to none. So what happened is we have students with devices, but no access to the internet.
Principal Trimble, can I just stop? Can I just pause you? Can I just pause you there for a second? But just to make it clear to listeners, you're talking about this grant that you got from Apple in 2015. And if I understand, correctly.
Apple,
so 800 students then got iPads. But what you're saying is, obviously, without the broadband access, that just renders the iPad a really expensive piece of glass.
Exactly. It's like having a car with no gas.
Yeah.
You know, it looks good in the driveway, but where are you going with it? Oh. And there's no gas in the tank.
Okay. So tell me a little bit more about what happened then as you tried to figure out how to do school, again, remotely, and kids were effectively cut off from any kind of access.
Well, and then not only that, Magna, not only were the children cut off, but some of our teachers were as well.
Mm-hmm.
We have teachers that live in a rural community. So when they were trying to actually do the remote teaching for our students to do the remote learning, it became impossible. I had teachers that were like, you know, how can I deliver this instruction when I did not have internet access myself? So we had to do a lot of brainstorming how to combat this problem. So that we did not have, well, of course, we have learning loss anyway, but not, you know, so that it is not multiplied on a larger scale.
So then, okay, so there's so many issues. Education brings everything home, right? So talk to me about what efforts were made around the county to get at least some kind of internet access for kids who didn't have it at home.
Okay, great. So some of our organizations in our small rural community opened their places up that had access to the internet. We tried with our churches, we tried with some of our community centers, and of course, unfortunately, even with some of them, they did not have access. So our community was very willing to assist, but they could only assist so far because they had issues as well. But her superintendent at the time did make sure that we had 10 buses that were fitted with hotspots, and we have 2 schools in our district. So there were 5 buses placed in the communities of both of the schools. Now, that was an innovative idea. However, there were some parents that could not get their children to the buses where they were located.
Mm.
So again, we still had what we thought was a solution, but for some, it still was an issue because of transportation problems.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So Principal Trimble, I understand that students returned to the building just this week. Is that right?
Absolutely. They came back this week.
Okay, great.
And prior to that, in December, so we've basically been virtual since last March. But we had so many issues. We had so many issues with connectivity, and a lot of our children were not in their classes. So in December, our superintendent made the decision that we'll have at least 2 days out of the week where children is having issues or problems or connectivity issues can come to the school. So that helped. And then not only did it help our students, but it also helped our teachers. So we started doing that 2 days out of the week. And we averaged probably, oh my gosh, 70, I'm going to say at least 10% or 20, yeah, about 10% of our students that were actually able to come. And then there were some, of course, again, with transportation issues, were not able to. But that was, again, trying to find a solution to this problem.
I mean, it's trying to put a Band-Aid on a giant gash, really.
Absolutely.
But let me ask. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Sure,
please.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess what I was wondering is you know, now the students are able to come back in the building at least during the school day, have the internet access. But you're talking about a fundamental problem that hasn't been solved just because the kids can come back into the school. Because, you know, kids who live in other areas who have internet access at home, they're doing research online. They're like using apps to do their homework.
Yeah.
They're being plugged into the world, finding information about projects, et cetera. It sounds like no matter what, your kids aren't going to have that.
We are constantly behind the eight ball. We are continuously behind the eight ball, and there's a lot at stake.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about being disconnected from the world, that is a lot at stake. So not only do they miss the research, they miss it. It becomes, then you start seeing a lack of motivation because our students are feeling like, you know what? I can't keep up with these people. I can't, you know, we can't compete with them. You know, so it becomes a motivational issue. When I say a lot at stake, I had a conversation just 2 days ago with a father that came to the school. And I will say this, AT&T did a really good job. We bought our school district, another solution we did, we bought some hotspots ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we bought them, the parents were, you know, bombarding the door to get them, which was fantastic. So we were running out of them as fast as we could distribute them. But as fast as they would go out of the door with the hotspots, just as fast they would come back and say, it does not work in my area.
Uh-huh. Talk to me. We've just got a minute left here, but I want to hear from you a little bit more about that motivational problem and how, like, there's sort of this ripple effect throughout your students' lives from being disconnected from the world.
And, you know, and it is, you know, it causes mental stress. You know, they're at a point anyway where they're trying to get themselves together and figure out where they're going. So it causes mental stress for them. I've seen so much mental anguish, so much anxiety because of things that's beyond their control. So this is just something else that, as I said before, it is a divide. When we talk about the digital divide, this is a rural-urban divide. This is a worldwide divide. And when they know that they're expected to perform on statewide assessments like everyone else, and we don't have the access to do so, then they have this perception of, you know, why even try?
Uh-huh. Well, Kathy Trimble, principal of the Francis Marion School, K-12 school with 635 students in Marion, Alabama. Principal Trimble, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you, Magna.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about what the Biden administration's proposal is regarding broadband access in this country, what it does, what it doesn't do, if it would help people like Kathy Trimble in Alabama. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about broadband access, especially in the rural United States, and whether or not the Biden administration's proposal in the American Jobs Plan would do anything meaningful to truly get Americans fully wired up across this country. Well, let me turn now to Nicole Turner Lee. She's a senior fellow in governance studies and the director of the Center of Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institute and author of the forthcoming Digitally Invisible, How the Internet is Creating the New Underclass. Nicole Turner Lee, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, we're already getting some questions from listeners because we put out on social media that anywhere between 20 to 100 million Americans could be lacking access to broadband. And Jimmy Luke or Luque is saying, can you share a source for that estimate? 100 million seems to be a shockingly high number. So how do we know, Nicole, how many Americans are lacking access?
You know, I love that question from the person who listens to you because we don't know. That's part of the problem. You know, the Federal Communications Commission, who's responsible for the oversight of advanced communication system, has actually put out statistics as to how many people are not connected to the internet. And over the course of the pandemic, for example, they put out statistics suggesting that we've actually gotten better because we used to have about 18 million people disconnected. And maybe right now we have about 14 million. But there are other numbers that are out there. Groups like Microsoft, Broadband Now have actually suggested that this is undercounted. And part of the reason that is because we do not have a national broadband map that allows us to collect the type of user data that will be both precise as well as accurate in determining, you know, not just how a family is connected, but, you know, what is connecting them. I almost cringed when I heard about your DSL story. I'm not going to lie. But, you know, we don't know how many people are using what type of technology. And that's just simply because oftentimes this is voluntarily reported data. So we do need to do a better job of ensuring that we have this data first, because without it, it's really going to implode, I think, some of the future plans to accelerate broadband deployment.
Tina, this is so fascinating to me because I've been saying this for more than a year now, like the pandemic is a mirror on the reality of American life. And one of the things that's been reflected back over and over and over again is that, you know, this is just a fact of federal, state, local, how there's this patchwork of private sector companies that have control over certain areas. We actually don't have a lot of baseline data to fundamentally understand major issues like this, like where is the broadband and who has it? How are they connected? I mean, what would you say is actually preventing us from fully understanding or having like that basic baseline of a national map as you're talking about?
You know, I think we've had several attempts. I mean, back in the mid-2000s, in preparation for my book, I was going through some documents that I've written and testimony I've given, and I saw the same conversation happening in 2015. I think the challenge is that the digital divide has never been seen as core to the nation's assets as, you know, water, electricity, and other important concerns when it comes to social services, government benefits, and even policing. And when we begin to think about what this pandemic did to really highlight and amplify that being disconnected mattered. Mm. It mattered when you could not go to the store, you couldn't go to school or work or your doctor's office, that now we're actually seeing it positioned in a different way. And I think one thing I would like to point out to listeners, this is in some way no fault to companies who've made certain business decisions, to government who has had some lack of oversight of this, to individuals who in many respects are not adopting broadband. This environment has come through a very light tech touch regulatory approach where private sector investment has been the main way that we've actually seen these networks grow. Now, I think what's happening is it's not just about the ISPs, the Comcast and the Verizons of the world. We now have Facebook and Apple and other companies that have been added to this digital ecosystem, Amazon, right? And so this conversation that we're having today is very much an issue around where is broadband being deployed, but it's also an issue of how is broadband being leveraged to become the new economic driver for not just the United States, but other countries.
Exactly, because there's no escaping the truth now, the fundamental truth that we need it for learning, we need it for work, business owners need it to just do business. I mean, it is, like you said, it is essential for for modern life. And when I hear President Biden say, like, America's going to own the future, you heard Principal Trimble just say a couple of minutes ago that her students are so disconnected from the world, they don't see themselves as part of that future.
Yeah. I had the opportunity to go to Marion, Alabama as part of the research for my book. I made a point before the pandemic, I have to say, is go actually visit real people, because here in the Washington, D.C. area, you often don't connect the dots when it comes to the conditions and policies that we're making and the conditions of the people that are actually affected by our policies. But, you know, in Marion, Alabama, you know, that's a rural Black Southern area. And it's really the truth that she's talking about. I mean, the opportunity that came through the Obama Connect Ed initiative really gave her kids, I think, the tools to have in their hand this ability to get connected. But the pandemic threw that out of sort, because not only are you dealing with the lack of access, but you also have access in terms of proximity. Her kids were sitting on the stoops, the front stoop of their school. And that was not unusual. I mean, across the United States, there have been children who have been sitting in front of Taco Bell's and McDonald's, or sitting in what I call these parking lots, digital parking lots, to be able to access Wi-Fi to get online for school. And there are even educators and workers doing the same thing. And so when you think about what Dr. Trimble is talking about, this is an issue that I think the Biden administration is taking seriously. And it's actually an issue that I think most of the country is taking seriously. I've been doing this a long time, Meghna. We have never seen broadband like spoken of in the same sentence as other infrastructure. And it's been quite interesting because the digital divide is something that's been around for 20 plus years.
Yeah.
So this is not necessarily a new phenomena. It's just one that is more visible.
Well, it's more visible now, I think, especially regarding how it's having an impact on rural America, because I think for a while there was this unstated notion that, I mean, rural America is rural. Like it's part of the package when you live in harder to reach places. So let me just give you another example. This is Liz Shaw. She's a folk music teacher in Meigs County, Ohio.
We have to live with the narrative of, well, you chose to live in a rural area. That's just what you get. You're in the mountains. But we know that's not true. The technology is there. There's many ways to bring broadband into an area, no matter the topography, in this day and age.
And Liz believes, you heard her, that there has to be a way for her community to be connected, to fully join the 21st century. But it has not come along fast enough, and it hasn't helped her as she's adapted her business to the pandemic.
So I'm going to play the rhythm for you and listen to the pitches now.
Students came to my home and took lessons in person.
I believe you have the pinky problem solved. Nice job.
When the pandemic hit, of course, that was not a viable option anymore. So I realized I needed to convert to online lessons. Now, I have no broadband. I have no Wi-Fi. I have nothing. All I have is my telephone hotspot.
Be my echo. I'm going to play the little phrase. Your turn.
My husband and I both teach, and we both use different phone plans. So if one is being cranky one day, we can rely on the other one. So that's one workaround that we've always done that, because you just never know if your cell service is going to be there. So it's more than a broadband connectivity issue. It's also cell service. It's landlines. It's all connectivity.
Good job. Repeat now and drop one of the A's.
Getting online to teach has been a real heavy lift. And we use Zoom. We use FaceTime. We use Facebook Messenger. We'd use carrier pigeons if we thought that would work better. And my students have been wonderful. My local students live in the same situation I live in. So we're all used to children having to go to fast food restaurants to get their homework done, or business owners having to go to a parking lot at the library, which leaves on their Wi-Fi 24/7 to get some kind of business activity done. We're all used to that around here. However, because I went online, it expanded my reach, of course, and will be expanding my music one-on-one teaching. Pretty soon, I'm in the process right now of expanding it to being online courses, and that's also presenting all kinds of challenges. I'll do the videos here at home, and then I'll just have to drive into town and camp out for several hours to upload my next lessons.
Wow, Adelaide, that's amazing. Here's what's next.
That's Liz Shaw teaching the next generation of American folk musicians in Meigs County, Ohio. Okay, so Nicole Turner Lee, we could provide listeners 1,000 different examples like we've been hearing this hour, but let's dig into what the Biden administration is proposing and whether it's actually going to make a difference to folks like Liz, like Kathy, that we heard from earlier. So in the American Jobs Plan, the Biden administration says it's going to devote $100 billion to get all Americans connected. Sounds like a big, flashy number, but I feel like the plan is missing a lot of details and seems to focus more on getting prices down for people who can't afford it versus maybe the physical infrastructure needed for places like Meigs County, Ohio, or Marion, Alabama. What do you think?
So it's so interesting. And I think you're going to have me come back on another show and I can go a little deeper into that $100 billion, right? But let me stay on the example of Meg and sort of talk through, I think, what is really important in the American Jobs Plan, which is the $20 billion that's going to rural, because we do know that it was very much modeled after the legislation that Congressman Jim Clyburn out of South Carolina and Amy Klobuchar actually put together out of Minnesota, which is the Accessible Affordable Internet Act for All, where there is a true conversation going on in terms of how do we close the gaps in rural. One thing I think people need to understand is that rural is challenging. As part of my book, I'm a city girl. I traveled to Marion, 2 hours from Birmingham. I've gone to Garrett County, Maryland, which is right at the tip of Maryland State, Stanton, Virginia, tribal lands, as well as areas, you know, in Phoenix, Arizona, you know, just on the fringe of some more rural communities there. The key thing is we do have a topography challenge when it comes to rural. So let's just be clear about that. Mm-hmm. And we have proximity to the type of fiber outlets that we need to connect rural broadband. And that is always going to be a challenge because, as I always commonly joke, but it's the truth, sometimes there are more cows than people, but it doesn't mean that these communities need to be passed over because farmers need broadband, folklore teachers need broadband. One of the places I visited in Garrett County, Maryland, was a Amish school of 50 kids, five-room classroom, and they need broadband. So that's the first thing. I think what's most promising, though, since we started this debate around rural broadband many, many years ago, is that we now have new technologies that can get us there.
Yeah.
Whether it's 5G technology, whether it's TV white space, whether it's a direct connection to fiber, I think what we're going to be able to do with this $20 billion at least, or $100 billion, is figure out a way to finance technology agnostic solutions. And let me just say one more thing, and I know, you know, I'm on your show and I don't want to take over, trust me, but I think it's important for people to also recognize rural is not homogeneous. Mm-hmm. So you have people like the instructor who have business models that it's a matter of having sustainable broadband to be able to transition those business models in a very seamless, sustainable, resilient way. But then there's also this part of rural that I think is fundamentally should be a concern to all Americans, which are the very poorest of the poor, people who live in the Mississippi Delta or the Black Belt regions or in tribal lands that live in communities where they're not just not getting broadband, but they may have inadequacies in getting water. And we have to think about in this pandemic, how much do we also want to make sure that any down payment on rural broadband gets to those people as well. Because the more we do not trail this with systemic inequalities, the more, like I say in my book, they will become digitally invisible and therefore have greater consequence as we move to an online society.
Yeah, no, point well taken. Now you went through a couple of different options to help get like physical access to broadband in these rural areas. We've got lots of folks writing in saying, well, it doesn't have to be, you know, wired, it can be wireless.
That's right.
Yeah, and
you, right.
And folks, you heard Nicole Turner Lee just talk about 5G perhaps being you know, one of the main ways that we can do that. So the question is, like, there are lots of different solutions to help get people connected. It's gonna be a mix of them, point taken. But I have to ask you again, like, this is, I'm gonna come back to the money issue, because from what I understand, according to reporting from the Associated Press, between 2009 and 2017, so even before this current proposal we're talking about, there has been vast amounts of federal spending trying to
yes.
get people connected to the internet. More than $47 billion.
Yes.
And yet
yes.
we haven't done it. Where's all that money gone?
Well, see, that's the problem. I mean, let's just talk about rural broadband infrastructure for a minute. There are 2 to 3 different agencies that are responsible for this. And that money has a very burdensome process for small providers to even get through it to get the money that they need to actually turn on these connections. In my research, I went to Nebraska. And in the area of Nebraska, you have, you know, small broadband companies that just want to wire cattle farms. Mm-hmm. Or there was one guy that said, I just want to wire my community with wireless. And I've leased my house. I've leased my car. I've taken loans on this, but everything is probably financed except my wife. He said, because I just want to make sure my community of 500 people have access. And he could not present himself to the rural, you know, utility service or agriculture, Department of Agriculture, to get this money. So part of, I think, what we're going to see going forward is we not only need to have the money available, we not only need to realize that this money is just a down payment. It's going to require the cooperation of the public sector, the private sector, civil society organizations, philanthropic organizations, but we also need to have this centralized somewhere. And in my experience doing this for 20, 30 years, there's been no home for this. The FCC, who has taken this on, the Federal Communications Commission, they have oversight of a variety of functions. Congressman Clyburn is basically suggesting that we create an agency that is responsible for broadband development that can look at these monies in ways that sort of take all of the post-it notes and frame them neatly, right? So we have some metrics and goals. And I think, you know, to your point, this money has been out there for quite some time, but we need to again consider where is it going? And with the absence of a map, do we even know the bang on our dollar when it comes to some of the most impoverished communities, some of the most disconnected communities, and some communities, again, like tribal lands, where there are other challenges that need to be addressed to bring broadband even onto those lands. So I think you're going in the right direction, and I think so are your listeners. We've got to come together and solve this,
Nicole, you have the energy of a person who's been working on a problem for decades and only now is being listened to. Let me tell you. it's like you can feel the tide turning. I love it. We got to take a quick break here, and we're getting a lot of feedback from listeners. We've got a listener on Twitter called Fudge Tosser. God, where do you guys come up with these names? Who says, we don't need the government to build things like internet access. If we let them do it, it'll turn out expensive, anachronistic, and prematurely obsolete. Let the private sector respond to demand. We're actually going to talk a little bit more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the lack of broadband access for many millions of Americans, but especially in the rural United States, and whether or not what is proposed by the Biden administration in the American Jobs Plan would actually help to get more people on broadband. And I'm joined today by Nicole Turner-Lee. She's Senior Fellow in Governance Studies and the Director for the Center of Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institute and author of the forthcoming book, Digitally Invisible, How the Internet is Creating the New Underclass. Now, Nicole, listen along with me, because we were just flooded with so many examples of people who are struggling to get by without reliable connections to the internet. So here's another one. Up until just a few years ago, Lee County in eastern Kentucky did not have broadband internet access. In the past few years, though, there's been some progress, which has been a boon for tourism in the county, particularly because it attracts a lot of rock climbers. Here's Lee County Judge Chuck Caudill.
They are now able to do their work elsewhere while they're climbing during the day and night. And what that has led to is we've had an increasing number of people into the community who have no connection here except for their recreation that are buying property here.
But broadband access, even though it's there, is far from universal across the county. There are still swaths of that mountainous region where it's impossible to get high-speed internet.
Literally 2 miles past my house was the Alsa County line, and they had fiber optic. The people across the road from me had fiber optic, but I couldn't get it. It's just ridiculous. In this time, in this day, there has to be something. This is 2021.
That's Kimberly Sizemore. She's among the county residents who, as you heard, can't get a connection. So at the beginning of the pandemic, she had to move across county lines to her late mother's home in Breathitt County. It was the only way for her to telecommute to her job as a logistics specialist at Amazon. And for her kids also to attend a remote school. Even after the move, though, she had to upgrade her internet speed to meet Amazon's requirements.
So I pay right now, I had to upgrade an account to a business account to get the speed. I pay $160 a month for my internet and had to move out of town, not even in the city that I live in. I'm outside the city to work.
After months of asking Lee County officials to do something about it, Kim says she's just fed up.
At one time, if you'd asked me about internet access, it would not have been a number one priority. It would not have been something that I would have been so adamant about. But every day I see jobs. To me, it's jobs going out the window. Amazon just had a hiring event, and I couldn't tell you on both hands the people that messaged me back and said, my internet won't pass, or I can't get the internet speed. You know, that's taking food out of people's mouths.
Now, in neighboring Jackson and Owsley counties, Kentucky, high-speed internet access isn't a problem. But that is because of the fiber network built by the People's Rural Telephone Cooperative. It's a small phone and internet service provider in McKee, Kentucky, and they're expanding into Lee County, too. So I want to actually bring into the conversation now Keith Gabbard. He's CEO of the People's Rural Telephone Cooperative, and he's joining us from McKee, Kentucky. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Megan. Thank you for having me.
It's great for you to be able to join us. Tell me a little bit about what the PRTC is and what it's doing.
PRTC is a nonprofit cooperative. We started out as a telephone cooperative back in 1950, and of course, over the years since we've ventured into the television business and the internet business, and even along with four other small companies in Eastern Kentucky, we own a wireless company as well. So we, back in the early 2000s, we decided that our copper and coax network just weren't good enough, and we needed to build a fiber network. And we heard about Google building these fiber cities, and we thought we're going to try to build fiber counties, gigabit counties.
Yeah.
And so with the help of some of the Obama-era stimulus money, the BIP money back in 2008 and 2009. We started out with a $20 million loan, ended up getting a part loan, part grant to do more of our community, and we built, we placed all of our copper and coax lines over a six-year period with all fiber. So now everybody in Jackson and Owsley County can get up to a gigabit service.
Interesting. Okay, so you heard Nicole Turner Lee talk earlier about how the reality of the topography is part of the issue here. It's pretty mountainous there. I heard you had to go to some interesting lengths to be sure to get all that fiber laid.
Yeah, one story that is interesting is, you know, when we were first started building this, we did use one of our subcontractors used a mule to help. We do have some pretty difficult terrain, and it's sort of ironic to have a mule helping build fiber optic state-of-the-art cable to do gigabit networks. But we did use that in some of our areas. A mule named Old Bub, who's pretty famous around here.
Whatever it takes. That's my motto here. But Keith Gabbard, before the break, you heard me read that comment from a listener who said, just let the private sector take care of it. If it's demand, they'll come meet the demand. What do you think about that? Was that happening for you in Kentucky?
I think it happens in urban areas, but there's a lot of difference in cost of building a network when you have six customers a mile versus 1,000 customers a mile. And there needs to be, you know, there has to be, as we've found, some help, some subsidy or some help with the network. And that's what our network cost, $50 million. It was 60% loan, 30% grant, $10 million, and 10% of our own capital. So there was some help there to build the very rural areas. I think has to be a partnership.
Okay, and so just so I've got my terms right here, does the PRTC qualify specifically as a municipal broadband provider?
No, we're a nonprofit cooperative.
Got it.
So
okay,
we're owned by the people that we serve.
Okay, and how much of a difference has it made to those folks?
Oh, it's made a huge difference. I mean, I don't think we even realized how much difference when we started this in 2008. But I mean, from an education standpoint, I mean, all our students, have, especially during the pandemic, it's just been a lifesaver. And then from a telemedicine or telehealth or from economic development, we've had we work with a local job creating company here, work from home jobs. We've had over 1,100 jobs created, work from home jobs over the last 5 years. So it's made a huge difference. And, you know, as a nonprofit cooperative, and I've lived here my whole life, been with this company 45 years, we're really seeing that we can make a difference in the lives of the people that live here and make this a better place to live and work. And, you know, that it's very fulfilling to be able to be a part in that.
Yeah. I mean, you heard Kimberly Sizemore from Lee County just next door, like saying that she's having difficulty doing her work for Amazon, of all companies. I mean, she's really it's an economic imperative for her and her family's livelihoods. Now, Keith, hang on here for just a second. So, Nicole Turner Lee, let me turn back to you. If I just can focus for a moment on municipal broadband, which is not what Keith and the PRTC are doing, as he pointed out there, a nonprofit cooperative. But municipal broadband is actually part of the picture here. But from what I understand, there are at least in 20 states, there are regulations that restrict municipal broadband from existing. So you can't get that competition in. There's still the local monopolies for the cable or broadband providers.
Well, you know, I want to talk about the municipal broadband piece from the history of it. I was involved early on municipal broadband, and some folks who are listening remember Earthlink, who was probably one of the catalysts for municipal broadband years ago. I hear you laughing. You know what I'm talking about.
I'm feeling my age now.
And there was a lot of energy around the fact that, you know, cities and communities could build their own networks under the pretense that they would be able to have government services as anchor institutions on those networks. Now, that was, you know, I don't want to date my age. And I'm glad you all can't see me, even though I still look young, but that was almost 15, 20 years ago. And so here we are, fast forward. A lot of the reason that we saw the institution of these bills and laws had a lot to do with, you know, the fear of overbuild. And there were several municipal broadband networks over the years that have gone bankrupt. And so I think we have to just really be careful about thinking about, well, maybe we should just go back to the municipal broadband framework. I really love what your guest is talking about in terms of non-profit cooperatives. I think the issue is not picking and choosing winners and losers mm-hmm. in this marketplace. I think we have to figure out how do we get broadband to the people, no matter what form it takes. And I love the point that was just made, that we have to make it much more accessible for people to get the type of capital that they need. So in some cases, there may be a private sector route for this, urban communities where there's a keen return on investment. In other cases, we may need government to come in because there's no return on investment and they need to put their money where their mouth is and give it to companies like the one that's showcased. In other cases, we may need the ability of people to get financing on these issues. And that's what we're seeing in some of these bills, which are being downplayed a little bit, the ability to get financing directly from the government as opposed to going in and trying to fill out all the paperwork for some type of loan or indebtedness. I think at the end of the day, we need to take, again, those post-it notes I talked about earlier, lay them out with a national broadband map and figure out what's the best way to get there. If we find ourselves going back down the rabbit hole in terms of dogmatic debates on whether or not we should try to, you know, get rid of some of these laws to prevent overbuild or put in more laws to make sure that we get to these certain places, we're going to disservice the American people because we have been down this route before. And I think what you're hearing in what was said about the mules carrying the fiber, those are real stories.
Yeah.
But we also have other opportunities to bring in alternative technologies that, again, if we're technology agnostic, we can actually solve that, you know, with the help of a collaborative team of people around the table trying to figure out where the resources should go.
Well, Keith Gabbard, let me turn back to you here for a second. It sounds like what you've done with the PRTC can serve as an excellent blueprint for other rural communities that are looking to somehow bring broadband access. You must have heard from other folks, have you?
I have. We've got a lot of calls since the word came out that we've done this and we've got some publicity, but there are a lot of small companies like us doing this. I mean, we're members of the National Association, NTCA, Rural Broadband Association, over 850 companies. And I mean, there's 11 of them in Kentucky. There's a lot of companies doing this, but and one thing in Lee County, we have went after some government USDA loans and grants, and that's how we've been able to move into Lee County and you know, compete against one of the national companies that's just doing DSL there. It's going to take us a while, but we're going to get a lot more of Lee County as we move forward.
And just quickly, so it obviously took some government seed money to help get the infrastructure in, but then, as you said, the PRTC is owned by its users. Are the monthly costs, what are they like? Are they affordable?
Yeah, we can get 100 meg is the lowest speed we sell up and down for less than $40. We can get a gig for less than $90. So we have competitive prices.
Yep. That's way better than what I'm paying now, Keith. So it sounds like a really good deal.
You need to move down here or come visit us.
Well, this is one thing that, you know, like, again, like getting rural communities wired up. You heard the judge earlier say that folks are coming in because, you know, like the pandemic's upended everything. And for those lucky enough to not have to actually physically work, you know, where their businesses are located, places like, you know, McKee, Kentucky suddenly become super attractive. So
I met a guy down at the post office just a few weeks ago from New Jersey, and he and his wife had just bought a farm and moved down here, and they both did cybersecurity from home, and they'd heard about our broadband. That's one of the reasons they came here.
Yeah. And if I could jump in real quick, yeah. I tell a funny story. When I was doing some field work in rural America, one of the guys said, you know, getting broadband down here is like having the ice cream truck actually stop in your neighborhood because they can offer you something. They know they're going to sell a few popsicles, and they don't have to just sell you the great ones, right? And I think that reality is really what's happening, right? The fact that it's not just about the broadband for your job. Think about the ride sharing applications that can happen there. Think about the other telework opportunities. So we do have to solve this problem, Meghna. And I'm all for Keith, you know, Team Keith, in trying to, again, get that mule up that hill to bring that fiber.
Well, Keith Gabbard, CEO of the People's Rural Telephone Cooperative, providing high-speed internet in Jackson and Owsley County, Kentucky. Thank you so much for joining us, Keith.
Thank you very much, Magna.
So, Nicole Turner-Lee, we just got about 2 minutes left here, and I want to ask you, against a lot of times where there are a multiplicity of good solutions for a problem that seems to have actually sort of bipartisan support, like people want to fix this no matter what side of the aisle they're on and where they live, and yet we've been struggling as a country. Why do you think that is? And again, in the last minute that we have, do you really feel like that could be changing now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I testified for many hours yesterday before the Ways and Means Committee on Infrastructure, and it's becoming very apparent that broadband is a critical infrastructure asset, like our water, electricity, and energy system. So I think we need to just continue to keep that top of mind. I think the other thing that we need to do is, and this is where I have written about this for those of you who are interested, around these Tech New Deal, which is a New Deal era type of approach to these programs. We do need to have a coordinated response to infrastructure deployment, adoption, and use, and we need to have workforce opportunities in the building of this infrastructure. So I think that's another thing. And then I think with the last thing, as the Biden administration moves forward, when he talks about complementary infrastructure, like soft infrastructure, no child should ever be left offline again. And we need to make sure that not only we build these roads that are internet enabled, but people have the tools to get on it.
Well, Nicole Turner-Lee, Director for the Center of Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution and author of the forthcoming Digitally Invisible, How the Internet is Creating the New Underclass. It's been such a great pleasure to speak with you. Would love to have you back. Thank you so much. Well, as we wrap up the show today, I want to say something about the person who produced this hour, Grace Tatter. She's On Point's associate producer, and it is Grace's last show with us. And it is, as always, really bittersweet for us. Bitter because it's hard to lose a great team member, and sweet because you've heard what passion and creativity she brings to radio journalism. Seeking out the kinds of voices you heard today, looking for the guests who can get us into a space where we're thinking about solutions to the huge challenges we're facing. Grace also has a specific expertise in education, and if there's ever been a year where all of the issues facing public education in the United States came into sharp relief, this pandemic year was it. I have been so grateful for Grace's insight and thoughtfulness as we've tried to figure out how to best tell that long, complex story. Grace has also brought kindness and good humor to our team day in and day out, even when the going gets rough, which it has for all of us at one point or another. Grace is leaving us to set her sights on taking those talents further into reporting original stories. And Grace, I know you're going to do a terrific job. So thank you so very much for being part of the On Point team. We're going to miss you, and we wish you all the luck and success in the world. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.